all the way live from Oakland, California. This is Revolution. And I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart, because we have finally hit our 100 patron mark. We are over 100 patrons, so thank you guys oh so much for making that possible. Originally, when I had set out to do this thing, this was more music-based, so our 100 patron thing that we were going to do, celebration, if you will, was more music-centered. I think we're going to change it up. I don't know if the people that are patrons now are huge metal punk fans, so we're working on some things for the 100 patron episode. Also, we've hit our 1,000 subscribers on YouTube, so thank you guys very much. The live stream, if you didn't know, happens every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Saturday is what we like to call the free show, where we don't cut it after an hour, and we stay on for sometimes 5 hours and bring people on. The Saturday show for me is more like a real deal trip to the barbershop. Growing up in Richmond, California, the barbershop that I went to definitely had a certain vibe on the weekends that like everybody in town was there, right? Because it's the one day you work 5 days a week, or you go to school. Like, I was going to school at the time, Monday through Friday, so Saturday was the one day you can get cut. And no matter what time you got in there, it was packed, and it was packed with fun and sometimes information. Game was definitely dropped. So that's what the Saturday sessions for me are like, or the free show, as we like to call it. Last week we had Professor Sora Han, and we talked a lot about the Stop AAPI Hate movement. And then we had Ben Dixon from the Ben Dixon Show, and actually talked some black politics. So this coming Saturday, who's going to be on? You're going to have to check and see. I don't even want to tell you. All right, I'll tell you. We're going to have Jamie Peck from the formerly of the Majority Report, from the Antifada, and Angela Walker, Green Party vice presidential candidate, and also friend of show. She's been on the show before. So I'm excited for that. And, of course, the Saturday cast of characters, which is myself, my co-host Pascal Robert of Black Agenda Report, and Marcus of the Left Flank Vets. So that'll be a fun show to tune into April 3rd. But this show that I'm introing right now is with Professor Marlon Barber, and he is a professor at Missouri State University. And he is a history professor. And he wrote an article, A People Capable of Self-Support. I believe it won like Article of the Year. Black Autonomy and Community Building Through Schools in Kentucky During Reconstruction. So black community building through schools. I'm just going to read you the introduction real quick. When examining the efforts of African Americans to create and operate viable primary and secondary schools from 1865 to 1870 in Kentucky, it is difficult not to contemplate what potentially might have been had national support for the black transition from enslavement to freedom not waned. W.E.B. Du Bois and several subsequent historians concluded that although the United States had the opportunity to fulfill the ideals of democratic society during the years after the Civil War, the nation generally missed the mark when it came to African Americans. One area in particular where scholars have focused on this missed opportunity has been studies of segregated schools in the South during the Jim Crow era. Academics have highlighted numerous struggles, such as black schools facing underfunding, poor facilities, the consequence of inadequate education upon black children, and violence from white residents in the region. Others have produced works on the political roles of black educational institutions played in the post-emancipation South. In addition, some studies have examined the broader social impacts of black children attending educational institutions in their own communities, while still others looked at black efforts to secure education on their own terms. The purpose of this essay is to examine the social significance of black schools to the communities in which they served. A closer look at African-American schools during the years following the war begs questions about how formerly enslaved Kentuckians make use of schools to not only educate themselves and their children, but also build community within their communities. By seeking and obtaining greater autonomy over their own schools, what obstacles did they face in their own efforts to create autonomous educational institutions at a time of crucial national and state political changes that occurred from 1865 to 1873? So we get into this and more in our discussion with Professor Barber. And if you are a patron, then you can go and actually watch the video of our after-hour segment where we dug even deeper into this and talked a little bit about the current state of this reparations movement. And I'm not talking like ADOS, I'm talking like these programs that are being deemed reparations in places like Evanston, Illinois. So sit back, relax, and listen to this wonderful conversation we have. It was actually a very good time with Professor Marlon Barber. So thank you for listening. Again, wherever you're listening to this at, there are links in the description. Subscribe to the YouTube channel so you can be a part of these conversations live. If you'd like to see the show grow and you feel so inclined, there's also links to become a patron. And I am out.
Order that proclaimed the freedom of enslaved African Americans in states that had seceded from the Union. Over 2 years later, the Civil War was ended, and by December of 1865, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified, abolishing slavery in the United States. Each of these steps helped nearly 4 million former slaves gain their freedom. These African Americans faced a long, difficult road to independence. And for many, it was a challenge even to find shelter and work. One of the first steps President Lincoln took to help them was urging Congress to establish the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, more commonly known as the Freedmen's Bureau, in March of 1865. The Bureau helped former slaves secure jobs by drawing up labor contracts and providing temporary housing, food, and medical care. It was also tasked with reuniting families that were separated during the Civil War. The Freedmen's Bureau legalized marriages and kept detailed records that are housed in the National Archives to this day. But perhaps its greatest achievement was in education. The Freedmen's Bureau established thousands of freedmen's schools in the South, increasing black literacy to above 30%. It also built several colleges that are known today as historically black colleges and universities, like Fisk University in Tennessee and Howard University in Washington, D.C., granting more than 1,000 college degrees to African Americans by 1872. The Freedmen's Bureau's accomplishments did not come easy. Its efforts were not supported by the majority of white Southerners, and many white Northerners were ambivalent toward its goals. After President Lincoln was assassinated, Vice President Johnson took his place. As a Southerner, Johnson had little sympathy for the former slaves. He quickly cut funding to the already unpopular program. At the same time, white people that worked for the Freedmen's Bureau often had to deal with ridicule. Even so, many Bureau workers stayed in the South, helping the Reconstruction effort by getting involved in politics, renting homes, and rebuilding their own lives and the economy as well. While the lack of funding contributed to the disbandment of the Freedmen's Bureau in 1872, its influence is noteworthy. For many African Americans, the services of the Freedmen's Bureau were a vital source of support as they created new lives and sought to claim their new freedoms.
All right. Welcome. We have a very interesting show. That clip is kind of a more tame clip. I believe it's from NBC or CBS News on the Freedmen's Bureau. We're going to get into that in a second. First of all, let me introduce my co-host, my homie, my dog, coming from the sunny, sunny, sunshine state of Miami, Florida, Pascal Robert.
My man, Jason Mons. How you living, brother?
I'm doing all right. Also, moderator John Ross is in the chat making sure y'all aren't going off all crazy, saying foul things. So let's bring on our guest. He is a history professor, a historian of early and 19th century United States, with particular interest in 19th century Black American history and Southern and rural studies. His research to date centers on Black radicalism and African American social institutions. He is currently working on forthcoming articles on enslaved and free African American radicals in mid-19th century Missouri, Black public schools in post-Civil War Kentucky, and alcohol production, consumption, and culture in late 19th century Missouri. His name is Professor Marlon Barber. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yes,
pleased to be here.
Glad to have you here.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So I'll get right into it. That clip starts off talking about Reconstruction. I am a product of Richmond, California public schools. Our Reconstruction was probably two pages long, and I don't remember having to answer too many questions about it, other than it was the period that happened after slavery. So my education on Reconstruction definitely comes post my education, right, on my own. And I have found that there is a contingent of Black people that glorify this era to a degree. Have you seen that too, Pascal? Like, this is the one era of Black prosperity. We got congressmen and senators, and we can vote, and there was actually more rights that we had that we lost, that we had to fight for again in the civil rights movement. How do you, since this is an emphasis of your study, Professor, how do you feel when you hear people say stuff like that to you?
I think there's aspects of legitimacy to it, because, you know, starting with individuals just becoming free. So, you know, you have that element. You have the 13th and 14th amendments, the, you know, ending enslavement, citizenship. So on paper, it looks that way. It looks as though, you know, things were changing. And then you do have changes at the state level with Black people becoming involved in the political system. So you do initially have these changes. So I can see why people would say that, yeah, you know, the United States is actually fulfilling some of its promises, mm-hmm. that, you know, it's in the embodiment of this democratic nation that it's promised, that it's said, you know, everybody's got a fair shake, everybody's got a fair chance, everybody's equal under the law. Mm-hmm. So I can kind of see why people would say that. However, it is undone quickly, and you know, you're kind of left scratching your head, because hell, there were even civil rights acts passed during this time period that protected people. The national government stepped in and passed anti-Klan laws during mm-hmm. this time period to ban, you know, terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can see why some people would say, yeah, they would agree with that.
Pascal, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find fascinating, particularly about your work, is that you focus on an area that many people really don't know about, mm-hmm. which is the way in which the education of Black people after emancipation really starts to form. And one of the reasons why I was particularly excited about this conversation is because I actually had done some research on the subject, reading two books that I had mentioned to you about. One of them by a man named James Anderson, The Education of Blacks in the South, and the other one being the white architects of Black education. One I learned in that research was that pretty much it is the drive of the freedmen after emancipation to have their children and themselves educated that really is the cri de guerre that gets public education established throughout most of the South. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. Because prior to that, prior to the destruction of the South in the Civil War, there were no public educational systems. And in many of these states, it was, you know, either if you were poor and white, you know, there was no public educational opportunity for you. And it was pretty much illegal for, you know, Black people, enslaved Black people to be educated. In Missouri in 1847, Missouri actually passed a law that prohibited any Black person from receiving a formal education, free or enslaved. So, you know, after the war ends, there's this big push by formerly enslaved people to obtain education.
Right, right. And you know, what I learned in my research is that that push was, what was fascinating is that the formerly enslaved were more vehement about ensuring their own and their children's education than even a large segment of the white population in the southern states. That they were the ones who were really the vanguards for pushing for educational infrastructure and educational institutions throughout the South. And I found that really fascinating because, like, one of the kind of racist tropes that, you know, is always pushed about Black people is the, you know, lack of focus of education. And, you know, you heard the stereotype of if you want to hide something from a Negro, put it in a book.
Put it in a book, yeah.
Yeah. But what, you never heard that before, Jason?
I wasn't expecting to hear it tonight. I'm over here trying to like retweet the show out, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, okay, I'm back. Oh, yeah. I'm back focused now. But I wasn't focused before.
But in light of that really insanely ridiculous and untrue racist characterization, upon emancipation, you are seeing formerly enslaved Black people pushing harder to educate themselves more than anyone else. But what is fascinating to me in your writing and the writing effort as well is the amount of opposition that they faced. So one of the questions I have for you tonight, and when we're discussing the struggle of Blacks post-emancipation to establish educational autonomy, as I mentioned, two of my favorite books on the subject were The Education of Blacks in the South, 1860 to 1935, by James Anderson, and The White Architects of Black Education, Ideology and Power in America, 1865 to 1954, written by William Henry Watkins. And what I found fascinating about these books is how much education was emphasized by the slaves, as by the enslaved Blacks, as a key to changing their circumstances. Yet the white power structure was very circumspect about not only education of Blacks, but the type of education they received. Can you elaborate on the various ways in which these struggles played out in the South?
Oh, yeah. So when slavery ends and the educational system is... the common school system, as it would be called, public schools, you basically have the creation of two different systems. And, you know, as the school system is even being created, you have Northerners that will try to shape or build that educational system in the model of the common school system in the North. And the thing that, and I don't even know if many people know about this, but actually the South got its idea of having a segregated school system from the North. There was an 1848 case in Boston, Massachusetts, called Roberts versus Massachusetts, or the city of Boston. Actually, it went to the state Supreme Court. And a young girl, she was about 6 years old. Her father was an affluent Black man in Boston, but she couldn't go to the closest school to her because she had to go to the Black school. So he sued. And it went all the way to the state Supreme Court there. And the state decided that, you know what it is, you can have segregated schools as long as they have equal facilities. That case is actually cited in the Plessy versus Ferguson case. Mm. So this idea of segregated schools started in the North. It started in the Northeast. And it wasn't something that the South just randomly decided. So, you know, when slavery ends and breaks down, you have the creation of this dual system, which is taxing financially because you gotta finance this. So it's super expensive. You have groups like the American Missionary Association that will send teachers down, mostly white teachers that were trying to recreate the school system of the North. And then you have in the South, you have legislators that were fighting tooth and nail to undermine any sort of Black administration of these schools. So, you know, that was a big struggle that Black communities had, dealing with an outside influence. So they have these teachers that are from outside of the South, that are outside of from their regions, that are trying to force a one size fits all mold onto them. Then you have administrators that are not necessarily a part of the Black community that are trying to dictate what should be done. And things didn't always go well and smoothly with the Freedmen's Bureau either. And so that's another struggle that they had. Then you combine those things and others with, you know, white fears of an educated Black population and fears that these formerly enslaved people are going to want retribution for their treatment under enslavement. And that came out and manifested itself in violence. And so you have groups like the Klan and other extrajudicial groups that begin terrorizing not just teachers and administrators, but individuals that were seeking to be educated in these schools. And so, you know, all of these things just kind of, and by the way, lynching, that's when that starts. You know, at the end of slavery, and as you know, Black people are now free and have this autonomy to kind of have more control over their lives. So, you know, all these things kind of combined and were major issues for Black people in the South. And one more thing, you have in the creation of a two-pronged, if you will, or a two-path public school system. This was also the time period where you really see white people kind of unite in the South, because before there were no public school systems. And so poor white people were kind of kicked to the curb. They weren't really needed per se. But once Black people were freed, and now make up a majority in some of these states, South Carolina, Mississippi, poor white folks are needed. And so then you have, well, what can we do to help them out? And so you have this, in essence, Southern, white Southern progressive movement that takes place in the South. And so poor whites, they get opportunities, they get the grandfather clause, so, you know, their political voice can be heard. They get tax breaks, public school systems are pushed, and so public schools are funded, and they can be a part of that to kind of get them on board with the Southern white agenda. So, you know, all of those things kind of, you know, culminate during this time that that really kind of speak to the struggles and issues that post-emancipation Black Americans faced.
I do have to ask, what kind of guitar is that behind you?
Oh, I have three of them, by the way. That's actually an Ibanez. It's kind of like a Gibson knockoff.
It's the Ibanez jazz guitar.
No, it looks like a Les Paul.
Oh, is it a lawsuit model?
No, actually, it's not. It's a more recent model.
Gotcha. I won't.
And it's got a broken string on it too. So
I won't. If you need strings, I have my own signature model.
I got to get one. I'm missing the small little E string. I broke it.
Sorry, people were asking about the guitars in the background. And okay. Also shout out to Joshua Sanchez, who said that he missed some shows because he just got married. Thank you for the super chat and congratulations on the nuptials.
Indeed. Jason is a big time band traveler, so when he sees guitars and instruments, it piques his interest.
I do lose my mind a little bit. So.
I'm not even going to lie. I saw the cast with from a couple weeks ago I can't even remember which one it was, but I saw one and I saw your guitar in the background and I was doing the same thing. So, what is that? What you got back there?
Someone said, you guys should jam after the show. I was like, you know what? I can't. I turned my amp on one day just to turn it on and I got yelled at by the lovely woman that I live with. Beautiful woman. See, great woman.
See, my two boys have working on going keep to bed and see, I can't. No, I get yelled at too.
Oh, I haven't turned. That's just a decoration at this point. But this is we'll get into it in the after hour segment for patrons only. But but I wanted, you know, so I printed your paper out, and again, it's a very interesting paper. And if there's a way we could share it, I would really love to share this paper with people because there was a lot of things in it that I was not aware of. Did you feel the same way, Pascal?
I thought it was a very good paper that detailed a lot of the ways structurally that the state of Kentucky went above and beyond the call of duty to really limit the ability and the capacity of formerly enslaved people to have educational autonomy. It was cool. It was kind of eye-opening.
Cool. I do have a digital copy of it, and not I self-aggrandizement. I definitely not me. But it actually did win Article of the Year in 2019 for the American Educational History Journal.
Oh, you didn't tell us all that. We would have said that first. We brought the ass on here. Don't be humble about that shit.
That's how we roll in Missouri. I can't help it.
You should have had a little. Like medal on too with the trophy behind you, like an Oscar.
I got medals here.
Oh damn, look at that.
I was a college athlete too.
Oh
that's another podcast though.
You wrote here, Black Kentuckians viewed their schools as institutions where they would overcome their past as slaves and build a community. Furthermore, their school offered moral direction and a location where they could voice political opinions. Moreover, African Americans in the state saw schools as significant social institutions within their communities. Schools safely served to inform students and community members on Black social decorum as they transitioned to a free people where students were under the tutelage of nurturing Black teachers and administrators. Now, one thing that really interests me in reading this is when you talk about there was one point where there was a school district that had, I think it was a 58 teachers for 4,000 students. Mm-hmm. That's insane.
Yeah.
So we had a bit of a shortage of not just good, as we always say, good teachers, but teachers in general.
Any teacher, yeah.
And yeah. So they had to have white teachers that came in who, as you write about, were very problematic, didn't want to be there, it seems like.
Yeah, in some instances, you know, didn't want to be there and didn't understand the social and political dynamics of the Black community, which can be problematic in any situation if you go into it and you just don't know the people there, you don't understand the people there. But I mean, you know, that was kind of the nature of schools in Kentucky. And that's also one of the things that I'm really interested in looking at, and kind of what does the evidence show about how these people wanted to run their schools? You know, what did they think about the educational system? And, you know, what they wanted to emphasize was not always the same thing that outsiders wanted to emphasize. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was a shortage, you know, but, you know, they, and part of the reason there was a shortage is because people were hungry. People were hungry for this opportunity that had been denied them for generations, for centuries. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just children, man, it was grown folk. It was grown folk that, mm-hmm. that wanted this opportunity. And so whether it was, you know, school during the day, school during the evening, school on the weekends, you know, they did whatever they can do to obtain, you know, an education, something that was denied them. And, you know, the more research that I have done shows that even prior to the end of enslavement end of enslavement, people found ways to educate themselves. I mean, in Missouri, and this is also why I wanna look at, you know, other places, but in Missouri, you know, there was a man by the name of John Barry Meacham, and he was a free Black man, and he owned a steamship, and he ran a business on the Mississippi River and the Missouri Rivers. But he was also a Black slave owner. Hold on. So what he did, and he understood the laws of Missouri, he was a Black preacher too, what he did was, since Missouri said no person can be educated, he took people, enslaved and free Black people, out on the Mississippi River, and they had school. Missouri has no jurisdiction on the river. And so he educated them. He taught them trades. And so once they were freed, and he always intended to free them, they would have education, they would have a trade. He was setting them up to succeed beyond just, you know, the here and now, as far as their situations.
That's so interesting that you say that, because I know how I'm sure you thought we were going to push back and say Black slave owners didn't exist. That's not real. What are you talking about? Negro lying man. We're constantly very much existed. What'd you say? What'd you say, Pascal?
I said it very much existed. It very much existed, particularly in Louisiana.
No, we weren't going to push back at you at all for saying that. We were more like, oh, he actually said it. So it was on our arm. We're like, oh, cool. What I wanted to start the show off with, and I couldn't find it, I was looking, was some, and unfortunately, there's just no footage of it. I was even looking for a shitty reenactment of any of the debates between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois.
Oh,
especially when it comes to, like, you know, Black education.
Yeah.
And in reading this piece, I kept thinking about actually Booker T. For some reason, especially when you're talking about, like, how it seemed like white people wanted Black people educated to only a certain level. Go ahead, Pascal. You want to say something?
That actually fits right into the question.
That's why I'm here.
The focus. No.
Uh-oh. Did you freeze?
The Booker T. Washington's industrial model of education. Did I freeze?
Keep talking.
Good.
Back now?
Kind of. Okay. We can hear you, but you're stuck. You're stuck. Just talk. Yeah, but you can talk. We can hear you. That's fine.
The The focus on Booker T. Washington's industrial model of education, which was often preferred by the dominant power structure to keep blacks tied to a substandard labor production, played a role in limiting the range of educational opportunities black students could attain. Can you discuss the nature of the industrial educational system and how it limited educational opportunities and options?
There was, as Jason pointed out, there was a big debate between Washington and Du Bois on the direction, nature, not the importance, but definitely the direction and the nature of education for African Americans, Black Americans. I prefer the term Black Americans. I try to mix it up though, but I prefer the term for a variety of reasons. But anyway, I think that Booker T. Washington's approach was safer. It allowed industrialists and philanthropists and Southern whites to feel safe. You know, when you have Black people being trained as not just menial laborers, but in a capacity that doesn't seem like it's going to promote critical thinking, and I don't want to use an anachronistic, you know, scenario, but if you are training someone to be a silversmith or a blacksmith or a carpenter, or, you know, that is seemingly much safer in a post-emancipation South than someone who is going to challenge the legal system, than someone who is going to be involved in journalism, or someone who is going to, offer theories and philosophy and sociology and critique the social structure or the political structure if you're talking about the legal system. And so I think that Washington understood that. He knew that. He was born into enslavement. He understood the South. And he took that approach deliberately because he knew that that's what it would take to at least one generation beyond emancipation. It wasn't something that, you know, I would imagine that he's thinking, you know, people have just been freed. And it's a bit much to ask, hey, you know what, let's you know, start promoting individuals and getting individuals into the legal system. He kind of understood the backlash that Black people in the South would face. Du Bois, being a Northern Black man, I'm not sure he quite understood that or accepted that. And that's perfectly fine. You know, he had the right to do that. But, you know, I think that the debate also includes those differences. And Washington understood that and he knew that. Now, I think that that held Black people back in terms of, well, we're just going to take this industrious approach. We're going to take this this approach where we prepare individuals for certain trades. I just think that it was a short-term goal for Washington in terms of kind of the nature of what he was promoting at Tuskegee. But he did understand the situation.
Yep.
Oh, did you freeze? You there, Pascal?
Are you? I'm right here.
Okay, you were cutting out. What were you saying, Pascal? You were saying something at the end of...
I was saying the thing that's interesting, though, is that at the behest of these, you know, the Southern planter class and the Northern industrialists, Booker T. Washington kind of won the debate because his model of education is what has actually continued up until throughout the 20th century. A lot of people always think that, like, Du Bois won that debate and that's why things got messed up. People are like, no, actually, Booker T. Washington's plan and agenda was actually the one that was implemented throughout the South.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's, and you know, so you have individuals, you know, in schools in the South that, you know, they emulated the Tuskegee model. That's, I mean, that's what they implemented. They implemented that. There was, and that's a reason, you know, he had the ear of the Northern industrialist. And so he was able to get dollars. He was able to get, you know, contributions to his school, you know. So, I mean, he did what he had to do. His model survived and implemented, or was implemented. Yeah, absolutely.
You write here in your paper, many Black Kentuckians envision their public schools not only as institutions of learning, but also places where their children could enjoy a secure social experience under the leadership of Black educators and administrators. Renowned sociologist W.B. Du Bois argued that post-Civil War education opportunities for Blacks would develop some, but surely not all, necessary social leadership to seek the right sort of leadership from other groups, to strive for increase in knowledge so as to teach themselves wisdom and the rhythm of united effort. That's from 2015. His assessment of Reconstruction's failure for African Americans highlighted that while educating was important, schools also allowed for Black peoples to establish social connections with their peers, Black teachers, administrators, and others. The development of those crucial social bonds and skills would serve Black children well once they became adults and navigated a world where their racial identity would mark them. Having control over their public schools was a departure from their previous experience under enslavement, as laws prohibited them from formal education or engaging in unmonitored and unsanctioned interactions with other African Americans in the state. This is where my mind was kind of blown, as we constantly talk about a surveillance state in 2021. We talk about this as if it is a brand new phenomenon.
It ain't new.
To read this and go, you mean that these cats were surveilled to levels that we talk about today? We even talk about things like COINTELPRO. The level of surveillance was kind of, seems like on another level for the time, right? Like, you Negroes can't get together. We don't want you going to church.
No, it had to be monitored. I mean, and I'm not just, and many times people think that it's just, well, it was just the enslaved people. No, it was all Black people in states where slavery was legal, because there was, and James Blassingame in his book on slavery. Yeah. He talks about the pathology of fear. And how, you know, white fear drove the this need, if you will, to constantly keep a watchful eye out, because the biggest fear for, you know, many of these enslavers and people, even after slavery ends, was retribution. You know, mm-hmm. people were fearful of a Haiti, you know, Haitian Revolution style, you know, vendetta taking place in the United States. And, you know, there were some, you know, some incidents where that happened. You know, have Nat Turner's Rebellion. Mm-hmm. You have the Stonewall Rebellion in South Carolina. But after emancipation, Black people were like, cool, we want to do our thing. Whatever, leave us the hell alone.
Yeah,
we ain't worried about getting back. We're not worried about that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so there was never this notion of you know, Black people gathering together and exacting retribution for enslavement. If there were incidents and violent incidents, they were initiated by white people after the Civil War. Places like Memphis, 1866, riots, New Orleans, riots. But those were white people attacking Black communities. Those were not,
slave, you know, revolts people, or any sort of,
no, or former slaves. No, no, yeah. No.
Someone wants to know, do you have any knowledge of how many slave owners were Black?
Oh, good Lord. I am not certain. I can say that there were some in Missouri. Mm-hmm. Some were of mixed heritage, mixed racial heritage. Mm-hmm. And that is because of the French legacy in Missouri. It was part of the Louisiana Purchase. And so there's a long French legacy, which is also true of Louisiana and New Orleans. So there were black slaveholders, black enslavers in New Orleans. There were also some in Charleston, South Carolina. The ones in New Orleans actually even tried to form a Confederate regiment. And the white people down there were like, hell no, we're not arming y'all.
I was not aware of that. Were you aware of that, Pascal?
Yes, I was. I mean,
Louisiana Native Guard.
Can you imagine just an army of light-skinned Negroes just ready to fight?
So they could protect their slaves.
So just they can protect Howard, their slaves. Just a Howard Hewitt's army is what I would call it.
Oh, my goodness. Shalimar.
Sang in Shalimar.
Shalimar.
He sang in Shalimar.
Playing to win.
Howard Hewitt also was the first black man I saw that was not afraid to have all of his taco meat out.
I don't even know what that means.
Chest hair.
Chest hair. Oh.
Looks like taco meat. So there's that.
So I had another question I want to ask you, Professor. On the role of white philanthropy in shaping black education post-emancipation and how it often clashed with the aspirations of black communities, like the roles of things like the Rosenwald Trust, Rockefellers in shaping black education in the South was quite profound. Can you share what the main difference in these goals with white philanthropies and black constituents were?
The way that I think about that is if you are a philanthropist and you are contributing millions of dollars, we're talking about capitalism. And for most individuals, if they are giving something, they want some sort of retribution. You know, what am I going to get in return for this? What is my ROI? What is my return on investment? So I'm giving this money, and in some instances, you know, it might be naming the school after this individual or naming a building after this individual. Mm-hmm. For many of these philanthropists, I think that the approach was having some sort of influence in how these schools were administered, and how they were operated, who might have been able to work at these schools. And I think, going back to a previous question, this is one of the big reasons W.E.B. Du Bois did not get a job at Tuskegee, because Booker T. Washington understood that. And when he and Du Bois got into it, mm-hmm. Reading between the lines, that's one of the reasons why Du Bois had to leave Atlanta. That's why he left and went back north. He pissed off the wrong people. And so I think that, you know, when it comes to the philanthropists, there was this expectation of reciprocity. Now, when it comes to many of the black people, they didn't want to give up control of their schools because they understood their communities. They understood these were their children. This was their future. This was their legacy. And why are you going to put that in the hands of someone else who's not a part of your community, who doesn't understand you, who doesn't know what you have been through, who doesn't know what you need to do to succeed? And so I think that part of the disconnect was, you know, while you have these individuals that were given lots of money, absolutely, Carnegie, Rockefeller, you know, absolutely, that black people were like, thank you, but we got this. and we want control of these institutions. And much of my research, as far as this article, it deals with primary and secondary education. And so these were heavily underfunded. Most of those philanthropists were giving money to higher educational institutions. And so, you know, but you know, when you look at the money, there wasn't a whole lot of money being pumped into the primary and the secondary educational systems.
And what's also interesting is that these philanthropies were vested into the Booker T. Washington industrial model, which, yes, as we demonstrated earlier, was the one that was not basically maximizing the educational potential, right, of the former enslaved and kind of keeping them in a kind of second-class citizenship position relative to the white power structure.
Yes.
Yep. I'm sorry, the chat is rather hilarious right now, but there is a question. No, it's actually funny in a good way. Pascal can't see, and I'm totally fine with that because I am making.
I can see it.
Oh, you can see it?
Yeah.
Oh, then you can see me up, making fun of you.
Making, yeah, first of all, I have AT&T. That don't boost smoke.
I won't go say anything about the dial up, but you know, hey.
So someone actually asked an interesting question about when you talk about this in your writing. M. Toussaint says, am I saying that right? Toussaint?
Yes, that's very good.
I've heard reports that emancipated formerly enslaved persons immediately sought to reconnect with sold family members, not go after white folks. And you actually talk about that in your writing about how people weren't allowed to reunite, right? Or stay. If you were reunited, you could. I got to find that.
After slavery ends, people went after, you know, mothers and fathers went after children. People in Missouri, I know they were going down to Texas. People had been sold down to Texas. People in Kentucky were going down to Louisiana. People were trying to reconnect with lost family members. Absolutely. That is absolutely true. They, you know, people were not concerned with any sort of retribution. They were trying to put their families back together or reunite with spouses, loved ones. Absolutely. And they actually used the Freedmen's Bureau to do that, to try to help them with that.
And how did that work out?
I mean, there were very few instances where people actually were reunited with family members. And many times, you know, when people were, especially if they went down into the cotton fields in Texas, South Texas, or into the sugar cane fields of Louisiana, they died.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I have a question not related, but as a historian, and you concentrate on particularly the history of the enslaved, what are your thoughts on the 1619 Project? It's a particular effort.
Well, you effed up, Varlin, in our chat. Outside of this show, you said, I wish I could have been on that show.
Yeah, I did.
So I, we can actually have this guy. We got 14 minutes to have this conversation before I want to ask you something that I definitely want to have off on the other side.
I stepped into that one. And actually what's funny is that I talked to John today when I was walking past, grabbing my my AV stuff from my office. I talked to him about that. I don't think I
could. He's not mad, is he?
Oh, heck no. He was pleased as punch. Oh, no. I agree. I mean, it's, and I don't know, the thing that I picked up on was that you had so many historians pissed off that it was a journalist writing this. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I mean, it's a different perspective. Of course, somebody's going to have a different perspective on what this meant. That's all right. You take it, you read it. I mean, if you disagree with it, you disagree with it. Okay. That doesn't mean it's gospel. That doesn't mean that it's going to, you know, dictate, you know, your opinions. It is what it is. But I mean, if you're talking about bigotry and hate and, you know, the legacy of slavery, you know, I don't think you can just boil it down to, hey, you know what? It is because of this that all of this other stuff, and we ain't gonna pay no attention to any of these other groups of people that have had to deal with their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I wouldn't kick it to the curb just because, you know, I disagree with it. You know, I see value in it.
Well, I was trying to get to this part of the discussion that unfortunately got shat on by someone who shall remain nameless. Do you think that the discussion has some value because of the way that slavery's been taught in the U.S. public school system?
Well,
in the sense of the oversimplification of slavery,
man.
Negroes came over on a boat. Abraham Lincoln said, be free boating Negroes.
No, I don't think so. And this is where I like whenever John was talking about this, it's like you can't boil it down to that. Mm-hmm. The experience that Africans had was so complex. You can't boil it down to just these two. In spite of being enslaved, they built a culture. They created something when there wasn't. You know, they didn't have much of an option. They resisted like hell. That's part of why they were doing what they did. Why they were, you know, I don't know. They were words are losing. I'm losing words here. But I mean, even taking it to what we're talking about today. I mean, having control over their lives. You know, that comes from that time period, from enslavement, having some measure of control. I don't know. I just, you know, I'm trying to shift gears here a little bit, but you know, that was, I just don't think you can reduce the experiences of Black people and every American to just that. Now, that being said, I don't think you can glorify certain aspects of American history and at the mm-hmm. same time completely dismiss the experiences, because everybody's experiences are different. Every group has had different experiences in this country.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw this. One of our guests, or no guests, one of our people watching the show, who's the artist, J. Andrew Worrell. Shout out to Andrew. Andrew has done artwork for the Ben Burgess Show. He drew the covers for the Michael Brooks book, and I think he drew Ben Burgess's book cover. I forget, but I know he drew a couple book covers. And has done some album artwork. He's a great artist. He's a comrade. He said that he wanted a dashiki in high school. Andrew is very white.
And one of them leather medallions.
And a leather medallion. I will one up you. I will one up you.
What decade was he going to high school? 72?
I think Andrew's the same age as me. I think I'm 43, Andrew. I will say I did go to school with a young white girl that had, remember when black college sweatshirts was hot in the 90s?
Yes.
I was in college then.
She rocked all the black college sweatshirts, and all five of the black kids that went to my high school, we was jealous.
Like,
all where, five of
where the hell like, did you get that southern shirt at?
Yeah,
oh, where'd you get southern sweatshirt? Where'd you get that clean
as to be have it clean? And then so we had a day. This is funny to talk about now, because now I think this wouldn't be laughed at. We had a day, this is a school I went to, you would probably call it progressive. It was like ethnic cultural day. So every club did some cultural shit, and she came in a full like dashiki with the little hat. And it fucked with me personally, because I was like, I don't know what to say, because I'm not offended, but I'm just more shocked that she wore it and is pulling it off. She's wearing it and no one's saying, people tried to fuck with her, but everybody was more in shock, because she wasn't doing it to like fuck with people. There was nothing about anything she did that was malicious. She was actually very, very nice.
Don't be mad, just be jealous.
Yeah, I was very jealous. I was like, you got every college, black college sweatshirts, and them shits was expensive. I went on eBay to try to find one, thinking I could get one for like 10 bucks, and they're more expensive now than they were then. Someone is texting me from high school asking who I'm talking about. I'm not telling you because I'm not busting this girl out. But you know who it is.
Oh, I know who it is.
Because there was only one. No, my friend. Knows who it is. No. She, Sora, Professor Sora Han went to school. We all know this girl, but everybody forgets that because she wants to block it out. Like, does she just have on a dashiki with the matching pants?
So Andrew,
you could do that. You could have done that at my high school and nobody would have fucked you up. You would have got some strange looks, but you wouldn't have got fucked up.
A dashiki with hammer pants. Wow.
Well, you know what I'm talking about? Like you had to have the pants to go with it because you wasn't pro-black all the way unless you had the pro-black pants.
See, we were wearing cross colors.
We had
those. And the shorts look like culottes. They look like short long pants. and the legs were just, you know what I mean, just look like tarps. So now when people are talking about, hey, you know what, we bringing back the 90s, I'm like, why? That shit was awful.
I definitely remember I had some cross color pants and they were big and baggy and they had a big X on them. And I had to ask, like my grandma had to get those for me. And it was a whole big deal. And it was one of them things where when you don't have a lot of shit, the one nice thing you have to make sure that you iron it. Right? Why'd you put it in the dryer? You got to hang dry it. Says so on the tag. Black people clothes, mama. I did that. My mom probably tries not to remember that time in her life dealing with me, but yes, I had cross colors. My mom, actually, to call my mama out, I'm going to call your black ass out. So my mama, I think she got a tax refund or some shit, and she took me and my cousin to the swap meet and bought us bootleg cross color outfits. And you know how when you got a broke dumb kid that doesn't know that he is buying bootleg shit, like I was that country cousin walking through the swap meet like, golly, they got Nikes for $10. I went to school thinking I was fresh to death with bootleg suede on my bootleg denim, and my mama did that. I just want you to know, Pam Davis, I remember when you bought them bootleg outfits from Durant Square Swap Meet.
You sound scarred.
I am. Kids tease me to no end. This is my mom. My mom watches the show, Marlon. I had my grandma buy a bunch of bootleg polo shirts because I thought polo, I didn't know it was a style of shirt. I thought it was the brand. So JCPenney's, who does not sell the brand polo, was right, selling polo shirts for $10, but they had a horse, but no man on said horse. So I convinced my grandma to get me these polo shirts. And I went to school. So I remember I had a blue one with a green horse and a gray one with a blue horse. So I would have a shirt underneath to match the horse color because I thought I was fitted. So I came to school with my shit. And I remember my friend, very good friend of mine, Ryan Tanaka, I will never forget this, stops me in the hallway and he grabs me, says, come here, man. And he looks at the shirt, he goes, where's the man at? And then everybody came over and started pointing at me and my shirt and said that the man fell off the horse on my shirt.
Oh, I was so broke. Horse ran off and left the man. Left him on the track.
So I definitely had We went from slavery to broke ass Jason. This is a fun show.
That's hilarious. I love these stories, man.
Somebody said there, I'm good. Yeah, I'm not going to talk about all the other bootleg stuff that you got me, mama. You got me a lot of bootleg shit. But that's why I love you. Because only a loving mother would take the few dollars she has to make sure her son looks good from a distance.
She's like, I see you didn't get the stop button, Pascal. I'm just like, I'm feeling the vibe.
Oh shit. So Professor Barber, are you gonna be able to stick around for a few more minutes and we could go into the after hours?
Yeah, that's cool.
Because I definitely want to ask you in the after hours. I want to, and I know you know this isn't your area of expertise, but there seems to be a reparations e bill in Evanston, Illinois, that some people are excited about.
Oh, okay. Have you heard about that one? Mm-mm. I've heard about the one in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, they have what's Asheville saying?
Well, Asheville, they're doing it as a city, and they actually passed it. So, and that was like
you're going to give Negroes money, or what are they going to do?
Mm-hmm. There are stipulations, but yeah, they actually passed it. It was either earlier this year. Yeah. What is it? March? Yeah. Late last year, early this year. So it's something. Look that up. Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, wow. So there it is. So if you guys are patrons. Oh, go ahead.
Hit the subscribe button. Hit the like button. Share. Become a patron.
Look at my mama. Look at my mama. Calling out.
Walkman bootleg.
Stopped after two plays. Eating tapes.
That's why I got one every year. Oh, man. So, yeah, if you guys are patrons, let me give you the link to become a patron. If you're not a patron, become a patron. It's inexpensive. And then you get to hear more chats that you don't get to hear. Oh, I thought that was, you know what I thought he had in his hand? A tall can.
No, it's an old English.
No, he thought you had an old English bottle.
So wait a minute. This for this last hour, you think I've been over here sucking down a 40? No, it's a tumbler.
I was like, damn, what part of Missouri is you from again?
Well, now that you say that and we are after hours.
Wait a minute.
We ain't after hours yet.
Okay. Well.
Oh my God. Okay. John Ross. Also, before we go, John Ross wants to know what part of Missouri you're from, because our chat moderator actually lives in Kansas City. He's from Missouri.
Okay. I'm from Southeast Missouri, from Cape Girardeau. It is diagonally from Kansas City. So just straight, it's Boot Hill. So on the Mississippi River. I grew up about 4 miles, 5 miles from the Mississippi River. And it's in rural. I grew up out in the county, cows running from deer. Playing in creeks, yeah. Riding horses.
40s on the internet. So
drinking 40s on the internet.
And we're going to talk about Marlon being from Rush Limbaugh's hometown, and he used to mow his lawn for quarters.
Hell no. Although the community where I grew up, the village where I grew up, because that's what it was called, the next village over, he did have some relatives there. They were cool people. I never had any problems with them.
Until you dated their child.
No.
Thank you guys for watching the show. Thank you guys for sharing it. We're at 1,100 subs. I'm so blown away, because getting to 1,000 was a Herculean feat, it feels like. So if you're a patron, stay tuned. I'm going to send you the link to the patron-only chat. Marlon Pascal, I'm going to send you guys a link shortly. Don't hang up right away. And we are...